Hey, everybody. Welcome to Roger and Me, a.k.a. Roger Ebert and Me, colon, movie reviews for SEO purposes, for search purposes, for surfacing our podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you find podcasts. We're trying to trick you into finding us. Roger and Me is a weekly movie review podcast that aims to celebrate the late, great Roger Ebert and, of course, Gene Siskel and keep their unique spirits of film criticism alive by simply reviewing all the new movies set for release theatrically, wide, limited, all of it, as well as streaming within reason. And this week we have 8 movies to talk about, including one major big wide release. It's a sequel. We've got Creed 3. We've got a new Guy Ritchie movie, but to be clear, it is not the latest Guy Ritchie movie. He has since made another movie that is already screening in New York called Guy Ritchie's The Covenant, I believe, because The Covenant is already a movie. So they threw Guy Ritchie's in front of it. But Guy Ritchie's Operation Fortune, Ruse de Guerre, which has sat on a shelf for a year, maybe two. It's been on a shelf for a while. It is now being, I would say, unceremoniously released. I am not sure how wide it is, but they did screen it, and Mark and I have both seen the movie, so we will be talking about it. It does exist, despite not feeling like it did for a while there. We're talking about Children of the Corn, 2023. But if you're savvy, you can find the same movie having the parenthesis 2020, because this movie's been screening since late 2020. I believe it was filmed before the pandemic and has sat on the shelf for even longer than Operation Fortune. Mark, I think we're getting right into it. My co-host here is film critic Mark Dusick of markreviewsmovies.com. My name
Hello.
Is... Hey, as if I need to talk more. My name is Brett Arnold, at Brett Redacted on Twitter. Mark, I think it was last week or maybe the week before. I think both qualify. I was joking that January was full of actual good movies and should not be called a dumping ground anymore. Maybe we should shift to calling February the dumping ground, considering this week we've got two long delays and a bunch of other little things that we'll talk about later. That there was a streak, Mark, where I watched 3 in a row that were all quite bad, and we will talk about them today. And I guess my point is, I say all that to say we now have to extend our bad movies come out in February thing, because it is now March, and this is the first weekend of March, and we're getting a lot of crap. So I don't know how you feel about the January to March doldrums, but I'm really feeling it this week.
This January felt really different, and now this week in particular really feels like what's going on here.
Yeah, we're definitely twilight zoning in the sense of it does feel like January, but it's March 3rd. That is the date. Is that correct? Friday, March 3rd, release date. Yep. For all these movies. We've already mentioned Creed 3, Operation Fortune, Children of the Corn, Palm Trees and Power Lines. This is a movie that I believe played at Sundance and is getting a limited release. We've got a movie called The Donor Party, which is a very, let's say, raunchy comedy with Malin Akerman and Rob Corddry and is it Jerry O'Connell? It's one of those guys.
Jerry O'Connell.
Yeah, Jerry O'Connell. Yeah. That's a movie that exists. We'll talk about that. A Little White Lie, a movie starring Kate Hudson and Don Johnson and Michael Shannon. It also exists. It's called A Little White Lie. There's a movie called Hunt Her, Kill Her, which played the horror festival circuit under a different title. It was called Night Shift then, if you happen to hear of that. But that is a scrappy little indie horror flick that we'll talk about. And then Bluebeck, which I said in my best Australian accent. Bluebeck. We've got Bluebeck, which has all your favorite Aussie stars, and they're back in the outback, and they're talking like they've never left. And not to disparage any Australian people, I want to make clear that I patrolled the reviews on Letterboxd for this movie, which is almost exclusively Australian people who apparently were forced to read the book Bluebeck when they were in school or uni. I don't know. I don't know what they call school over there. They were apparently, it's one of those books, like, I don't know what I would compare it to. I read The Giver in school, which feels like probably not that great of a book that you are forced to read. But I understand why people in Australia are read this book in school, because it's about like saving the whales and saving the oceans and conservationism and saving the environment and all that good stuff. But does that make for a good movie? No, but my point is, the Australian people, almost every review was like, I appreciate Radha Mitchell and Eric Bana coming to do a movie in Australia, but they really dialed it on thick with that accent. So much like Gerard Butler in Plane doing a very Scottish accent, people yelled at me as if I didn't know he was Scottish. Like, I know, but it's funny when they overcrank it. And I think that happens here. And you're going to hear more of that Australian accent, because I can't help it. It beckons. It calls to me. All right, we got to get right into these movies. If you can tell, I'm in the upstairs setting, which means this is a Roger and Me After Dark recording session. We're recording a little early this week, but thankfully we've seen all the movies. We're going to get right into it. The first movie of the week, Mark, unless speak now or forever hold your peace.
I seriously got nothing. Yeah, okay. It is late. We are recording late. I am in nice little shadow, dim lighting.
And I am overlit. My bald head is shining.
I usually have a nice little bit of sunlight coming in. Nope, not this time around. So I am ready to talk. And
we are ready to talk.
Yeah.
Eight movies. Let's do it. And we're going to do it in under 80. I'm calling my shot like Babe Ruth. I don't think some of these are going to take the full 10 minutes. But this one might, because I have a lot to say. And I haven't read Mark's review yet because I can't bring myself to do so. I'm going to have him break it to me live on the show. We're about to get into it. Fisticuffs are about to happen. We're talking about Creed 3, the directorial debut of Michael B. Jordan, who also stars. And did you know that he's already said that he's doing Creed 4 and he's directing? Because they already have said that, apparently.
Cool.
So there you have it.
I'll say that much.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, yeah. And you're not like displeased with that news. That's exciting.
No, I'm not at all. Spoiler, great. He doesn't die in this one.
Yeah, apparently. I was going to say, we really spoiled it. Like, Creed does not get knocked out and die in this movie. We can just say that now. Creed 3, trailer.
How long have you known each other?
We was like brothers.
One day you came back. The past came back too.
There may have been a time when Damien had your back.
No friends in the industry.
But that's not what he's doing now.
My brother's been my brother's mate. They ain't no kidding me a fact.
Before I got locked up, I was the best.
You a coward, bro. And a fraud. Try spending half your life in a cell. Watching somebody else live your life.
All right. That trailer gets at the themes that I found really interesting in this movie. Mark, for those who may not be aware, what is Creed 3? What is Creed 3?
Creed 3 is the ninth, as we did the quick math there in my head, ninth installment in the Rocky series. The third, obviously, in the Creed spinoff series, which I'm a fan of in general. I like the concept of it. For those who don't know, and if you somehow don't know what Creed is because you've been holding off on it, or because you didn't seem interested because maybe it's not about Rocky, maybe you weren't a big fan of boxing movies in general, check out the Creed movies. They're
check
really good.
Go watch the
original
Creed.
Absolutely. It's so good. I say it's as good as, if not better than Rocky.
I agree, and I'm still blown away that not only, like, in my mind, that is such a quintessential should have won Best Picture movie. Like, it's critically acclaimed, has the audience populist pick, was a box office hit. It's fucking Rocky. It just seemed like not only should it have won, it just wasn't even, the fact that it wasn't even nominated kind of blows my mind still.
It is. Yeah. I mean, that's impossible to believe at this point, especially now it's continuing on. It really seems like a big misstep from the Academy, which, you know, they're known to do. But anyway, so Creed 3 is the first one that is all about Adonis Creed. It's about Donnie Creed. It's no longer about, you know, his relationship with Rocky. Rocky Balboa is mentioned once in this movie, I believe, and that's it. And I really did appreciate that, because that's where this series, the spinoff series, has been going to, is to try to get at what makes Adonis Creed his own man. And what I'm going to say is, right at the start, it is all about who is Adonis Creed now. We get this quick flash of him as a kid when he was still in a group home before he was adopted by Apollo Creed's wife. We get a flash of him taking it all. He won. He's undisputed world heavyweight champion of the world. A couple of years pass. He's retired. And that's where we start with him. And I'm going to say, I think the first hour of this movie is really, really good, because it's not about boxing. It's not about any kind of, like, you know, grudge matches, not about any of that stuff. It's just about seeing where Donnie Creed is at this point in his career. And it takes it in a different direction, which I found refreshing and I wasn't expecting. And I think it is a nice reflection of the fact that, you know, Michael B. Jordan now is directing this installment. And there is this sort of mirror between Creed becoming this, you know, like almost like fight promoter and producer of, you know, co-producing his wife's music, I think, at some point. He's taking on this new role, being a father to his daughter in a very, you know, sweet and affecting way that I wasn't expecting. You see these relationships and how they have grown over the years. And it just sits there with them and it watches it and it sees where he's at right now. And you feel like he hit this character who we've seen go through a lot in terms of where he came from and what he's had to put, you know, deal with the death of his father and coming to terms with that feeling of not living up to his father and then trying to avenge his father through the whole fight. We've seen him go through all this, and it's nice to just see him relax and find his way and to see what that's going to be.
Yes.
First hour of this movie, completely unexpected surprise. I was really into it. That's what I'll say up until this point in the movie. But yeah, I mean, that's where I want to start with it.
I'm so fascinated by that, because I guess I'm assuming your criticism is like, then it just turns into like, we have to have a Creed fight movie and it just becomes that. And like, yeah. I'm sure that like that, but that's what it is. Like, that's what the formula is.
That is what it is. I think
that this movie is damn near perfect. I love this movie. The only reason it's not perfect is because something has to separate Creed from Creed 3, right? Like, I have to let you know Creed is still better, but like, goddamn, is Creed 3 definitely way better than Creed 2, in my opinion, which I did rewatch and I still quite like it, but that one is definitely more like, that is straight up a remake of Rocky 4, I think. Like, it's pretty much just doing everything Rocky 4 did with Adonis Creed. And this Creed 3, as you're saying, with like the shedding of Rocky, like, this is Creed's first, this is his own movie. And I love, you already mentioned the mirroring and stuff. I love the character of Damien, or Dame, I think is his name. I don't remember what his actual full name is, but it's Jonathan Majors. And he plays basically the mirror image Adonis, the man that he might have become had he stayed in that group home. And that backstory provides for such an intense and highly personal emotional stakes for the movie. And I think the movie really nails that for the exact reasons you're saying, Mark, of like, this is a movie where we're watching actual characters that we care about who have interior lives. And I love the way that the themes of the movie and the franchise, they always manifest, like, not just through Creed's boxing and stuff, but also through Bianca's music. Like, you were talking about how he's a producer now, and like, so is she. She has the hearing problems that are keeping her from doing what she wanted to do, and she has to now do the sideline role of being a producer. So I just was like, I love the way that, you know, as I was saying, the themes manifest in Bianca's music and Creed fighting. They're both producers. He's booking matches for upcoming talent, and she's doing the same thing. And these parallel paths, I just think it's so well done. But this movie is about how living out your dreams may not look exactly how you pictured it. And it's specifically about forgiving yourself and dealing with guilt that's stuck in your past, but harming your present and your future. And about that, like, imposter syndrome that successful people feel, where like, you feel like you don't deserve the things you've worked hard to achieve, maybe specifically because you're like doing it off the back of somebody else. And like, this movie is just about all of that. And I could talk for another 5 minutes specifically about how absolutely terrifying I found Jonathan Majors in this movie. Like, amazing, and you totally feel for him. But also, like, when he's fighting, and you get the sense from the beginning, like, this guy's like a dirty fighter and like doesn't care about the rules and will like do shit that is illegal during fights and do harm to people. And you really get that visceral sense of that. And like, he left me like shaking with just the way he would fucking look at people during the fights. and I genuinely feared for these characters. So like that intensity and the way he prances around the ring, it's so intimidating. And what a fucking commanding performance, especially coming off like 2 weeks after Ant-Man 3, where everyone was really straining, I feel like, to be like, Majors is good in this. And I'm like, no, I don't think so. I think he had nothing to do there. He was adrift, and he is a good actor, so he's fun to watch. But man, he is terrific here, and I'm sure you agree with that.
I completely agree with that, and I completely agree also with the setup for Damien, whose nickname is Dame. You had it right. Yeah. His that character, the whole setup. There's this scene of just sitting at a diner talking and reminiscing and just catching up with each other. And what, you know, he's been in prison for almost 2 decades because of something that Donnie as a kid did. And he stepped in, and now Donnie feels guilty because Dame, his best friend as a kid, went to prison, lost his shot at having the career that, you know, Donis has now. Yeah, all the setup is fantastic. I will not stop saying it. Yeah, you're right. All the mirrors, all the reflections, all the paths that we watch these characters walk to get to this point, and now we get to see them continue on a different path. I am all on board with this. I am completely on board with this. And you're right. That boxing match between Dame and Adonis's fighter, the Adonis's contender, the guy who's going to actually be like the next Adonis Creed. Right. That fight is terrifying to watch because there you get a sense of exactly what lines Damien is going to cross to get what he wants. And there's this like sort of throwaway plot development that I don't want to. I mean, I feel like saying a certain name in figure skating is going to give away something, but you see that coming a mile away. But just because you even have a sense that that's probably what's going on here, the character is more frightening, but he is also, you're right, he's completely sympathetic too, and that's a lot to do with Majors. I think with Ant-Man and the Wasp, what I appreciate about Jonathan Majors' performance is that he is just playing an actual character. He's playing it in a natural, vein, a natural air to him that we don't get from the Marvel movies. But that kind of performance comes through here,
and like this,
so much better.
This villain backstory being as compelling as anything else in the movie is like a new thing for the Rocky universe, right? Because Rocky movies, it used to be all about Rocky, and like the villains were like this one note. It's a Russian guy. It's this other guy. And they didn't really have compelling backstories, I feel like. And then I think you really started to get, and Creed 2 really gave you that backstory with Drago and his son that I was like, this is interesting. And I haven't seen this in a Rocky movie. And this takes it, you know, to the next level. And I found the villain stuff just as compelling as the Adonis stuff. And, you know, the movie's just literally setting up Adonis has to fight his past and overcome it. And I found it to be so fucking astounding, Mark, the visual flourishes, that first time director, just his visual language that he is already, I see in the press talking about how anime influenced his fighting style, his shooting of the boxing matches was. And I totally got that from the way he shot it. And maybe it's because I heard it beforehand and was just like, yes, that's what he's doing. But I loved it. And then like that final sequel, you know, the big matchup between Adonis and Dame, the visual flourishes throughout that with like, and did you find those to be corny?
Like, I thought it was so good.
I'm just like, the visual, the jail. You know what I'm talking about?
So I mean, here's where I'm at. You're right. I mean, as a first time director, this is impressive. There, during the fights, there are some interesting things and in, like using close ups to like give this idea of like Creed in that opening fight trying to find weaknesses of his opponent. You get that, and then with the fight with Damien and the up and comer, you're like, you feel all of that brutality going on, just kind of like just outside the eye of the referee, but we see it up close. And so it makes it feel even harsher and more punishing than it probably would look if we were just watching it from afar, like a, you know, like a cable network boxing match, which a lot of boxing movies I think have fallen into doing, is just using like the cable network, you know, broadcast announcers and all that stuff in that format. And it kind of cheapens it because we really want this drama of the fight. And yeah, he does get at that. I don't know how I feel about the major flourish in the big fight, if you will, because I'm not sure how I feel about the fight at the heart of it.
Well, I'm assuming there's go ahead.
I'm just going to say there's a turn.
Yeah. Okay.
There's a turn in this movie, and it kind of makes all the subtext of Dame's character into the text of what's going to happen in the plot. And I just didn't buy it. And that's all I can really say about it without giving too much away. It's just, you have this really compelling character who is both frightening, intimidating, but also sympathetic, and you understand exactly where he's coming from. And then this one thing happens, and suddenly it's just snarling villain on the beach with a bunch of people surrounding him. And I didn't buy it. And that's where I'm at. And then it just becomes training montages and all that stuff. It's just the formula of the boxing movie, the stuff feels like that these movies have been getting away from and focusing on the characters.
I appreciated the truncated nature in the way it was just like, yeah, okay, now we have to do all the stuff you're expecting. And I love that it just like, I felt that like it didn't waste any time. I was just like, it just fucking goes. Like the movie, you know, this movie has to end with them fighting. And like, I didn't mind that. Like, I guess I could feel them fudging it a little to get them to that point. But like, I just didn't care because I'm so invested in the themes of these movies and like how they're like, you know, just like these movies about boxing, but they're really, you know, about the everyday struggle of just living and trying to live your dream. And like, they're just such like quintessential American cinema to me, like American opportunity type of shit. And I think I just love that the series is still going and that it's richer than ever, I would say, still. And that like within the formula, these movies are still managing to deliver like what I would say are like heady ideas and like big themes and not just giving us big boxing matches. But they also are giving us the most visually compelling boxing matches I've seen since. Well, just Creed was great. Creed had incredible boxing matches shot by Ryan Coogler. And I feel like the second one definitely didn't have as distinct a style, and this one is definitely back to that, like, hell yeah, the fights are awesome. I'm bummed you didn't like it as much as I did,
but
it's clear you still appreciate plenty about
it. I appreciate a lot. Look, this is a better Rocky sequel than most Rocky sequels. That's saying something. I mean, I don't even know which one to compare it to. The closest thing I think of is like, this is the Rocky 2 of the Creed series, because it's not bad. It's just kind of, you know, a shadow of what could have been. And it does like kind of focus on, you know, the personal lives of these characters, but also trying to see what fame does. That's what Rocky II is kind of about. You know, trying to adjust to becoming famous. And now here Adonis has become famous and he's trying to find this new path in life. If we're at an okay sequel in the third movie, which isn't terrible. And I mean, I'm excited to see where it goes still, even though I didn't care for this one as much as the other two. I'm curious where it's going to go. I'm wondering what's going to happen, because I don't know. I feel like they've run the well dry of his. And that's the other thing. You said it's about him confronting his past. That's what the first two movies were about too.
I know they it's were.
This one is more focused on
shadow boxing his dad and shit.
Yeah, it's like this is focused on his life, not related to his father, and that's interesting. So I'm curious where they could take it next. Maybe not so much with the past. Maybe there is some way you can tie in his life as a boxing promoter into, you know, maybe not getting into an actual fight with somebody, but
I think it's clear where they're trying to go with this. If they pass it off to the next person, I think it's pretty clear what they're aiming for.
Oh,
in the future.
And I found that really compelling.
Me too.
It is just about a father and a daughter, and it's so sweet and it's so tender and it's so it's just nice to watch that relationship develop and be there. I really, really enjoyed that stuff of just seeing these characters. And kind of let down by the rush to the fight. You say it doesn't waste a minute, and I'm like, yeah, you're right. But I also think it could have spared a few extra minutes of getting to that point, because it does feel rushed of just getting to the big battle that we expect. But just because we expect it doesn't mean it has to happen. It could be something else. I don't know how to say that. It's just it's a boxing movie. It's going to be about boxing.
It literalizes the struggle into the fight, which is fine for what the movie is, I guess.
Yeah.
But like, I love the most interesting aspect to me is like the inherent guilt in succeeding where your friends didn't, or at the expense of them, not getting the chance you did and what that does to a person. I love that, like, that's the main struggle. I thought that was really interesting. But basically, this movie can be summed up as men would rather beat the shit out of each other than go to therapy. And that sums it up quite nicely.
Yep.
3.5 boxing gloves out of 4 for me. I quite liked Creed 3. I can't wait to see it again on a big IMAX screen. I saw it in a very small screening room, so I'm excited to see it big. I loved it.
2.5 for me. I don't hate it. I just think it kind of lets itself down with the second hour, and I don't know where it went wrong. It could have been a contender, but you know,
could have been a contender. did the scene, I feel like there's people who are either the scene where with his mom is going to get you, or you're going to like laugh at what it's going for. And it just got me, the big emotional moment. And I feel like other people in the room, I could feel them being like, all right.
I was fine with it.
I liked it. I thought it was so powerful. What a great movie.
It's another one of those things like, oh, that got set up so that could happen. And I think that's also, that feels like a Rocky sequel sort of thing, where just like some kind of medical problem arises out of the blue that's going to obviously play into
it's going to be some melodrama. Yeah.
It's like we can kind of keep that at bay. I mean, the first Creed did that so well with, you know, presenting Rocky having cancer and then just presenting it, but not, you know, letting it play out in a way that doesn't offer a finality to it, that doesn't, you know, it's, you know, that's all I'll say.
I
don't know what to say without, it's hard to say without giving much away.
Great movie, and we can just move right on without Mark rebuttaling at all.
I think it's okay.
I'm just kidding. Let's talk about the next movie, which is a very strange one, I would say. Guy Ritchie's, it's not called, I keep saying it like that's the title. It's Operation Fortune, Ruse de Guerre. It is a Guy Ritchie film, and it stars Jason Statham, Aubrey Plaza, and Cary Elwes, and some other guy. Here is the trailer.
As a private contractor, you possess a unique set of skills. What's that? Power up. You said it was clear.
I said the front was clear.
Front, back, right, wrong. Anyway, shall we? So what we got? Something rather nasty has been stolen. We have to stop that getting onto the open market. Who's the buyer? Greg Simmons.
The billionaire arms dealer.
Ooh, a lot of very serious faces up here, aren't there?
You can't catch this fish with conventional lures.
I'm sorry?
The lure being?
Tony Francesco. The movie star.
Greg Simmons' favorite movie star.
And how do we get him? Blackmail.
Guy Ritchie made his, Mission Impossible movie, I guess? I guess you could call Man from U.N.C.L.E. that, too. So maybe this is his second stab. It's his second stab at, like, a fun spy movie. And there's something so uninspired, I guess is the word, and perfunctory about it, and like rote, I guess is another word I would use. It just feels like you're kind of coasting from scene to scene. There's no real narrative drive or thrust. I feel like Guy Ritchie is counting on you, the audience, having seen a million of these types of movies before, just so he can just be like, yeah. There's a fucking bunch of spies from different countries, and they're all after this fucking MacGuffin. Go. Like, it has some weird lack of energy to it that I don't want to say, it just kind of played dead in the room. You know what I mean? Like, I was laughing more than anybody else in the screening for sure. But I feel like a lot of the humor falls flat. Aubrey Plaza's I find her charming and funny, but like, it's, her character is just weird. And like, I can't tell if it's like, she was improvising and that's why her character is the way she is, or if it's just written strangely. The only person who really comes off as like, that was fun and a great performance for sure, like Hugh Grant gets to be very fun. He gets to play the villain, which he's been doing in a couple Guy Ritchie things, I feel like, lately. But yeah, I don't know. There was this, maybe, is it because that Nick Cage movie, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, had the same exact premise? Like, is that why this felt so so?
Oh, you know what? Yeah. Oh yeah, wait a minute. Hang on a second. Yeah, because you know what I found the most interesting subplot to be was the relationship between Hugh Grant's character, who's this billionaire, who's a big fan of Josh Hartnett's movie star. And I liked both of those performances in this, probably the most of everything that's going on in this movie. But yeah, you're right. That relationship is kind of very similar to
the Pedro Pascal Nick Cage relationship, which is the best thing about that movie. The best thing about that movie is Pedro Pascal, who I've never been one to praise before. He's just like, everyone loves to praise that guy. But that movie, he is so fun. He makes that movie so much better than it has any right to be. And I would argue Hugh Grant's definitely giving his all. I don't think Josh Hartnett's giving a bad performance, but I would say I had the feeling like they should have gotten a better movie star type for this movie star role. It didn't sell it. He wasn't selling it for me in a meaningful way. But like,
yeah,
I don't know.
I kind of see Josh Hartnett as a bit of an underdog because I wasn't a big fan of him until I'll tell you, it was Tim Blake Nelson's modern day Othello adaptation where he plays Iago, and I'm really damn good in that out of the blue. And so there's this certain thing like in my head, like if an actor gives one like great performance, I kind of like, okay, I get it now. You're capable of this, and I'm a fan.
Wait, you're not a big theory. 40 days, 40 nights guy?
No, I'm not at all. But
you're not a big Wicker Park guy?
No.
You're not a big 30 Days of Night guy?
No.
I can't.
No, Josh Hartnett did back in 2001, and I know he's capable of doing a great performance.
So you've been waiting.
When he shows up here being charming like everybody else in this movie and being funny and being sort of goofy and how sincere he is about wanting to do the right thing, but also, being this, egomaniacal movie star, I'm like, yeah, this is a fun role.
Playing himself and is so self-congratulating himself afterwards, that is very funny and charming. And you're right. Everyone is charming. Yeah.
Everyone here is. And I think that that's kind of the problem. You said the plot is, is routine and it just kind of meanders. Yeah. And I completely agree, but I also think that's kind of what Richie is going for.
Yes.
It's more about these characters. It's more about, we didn't even say that Jason Statham plays Orson Fortune, which is a name that is so lazy in its rhyming scheme that I don't know. I mean, it's apparently like a nom de guerre for him and his character, but even then it's still kind of clugs with Lance, like, oh, that's the name he went with. That's
this
where the title came
is
from.
Halfway between Ernest Mission Impossible style movie and like a parody of one, I would say.
Correct. And I think that's what the issue is I think that it's trying to go off of the personalities of these characters. So you have Statham being, the charming action star that he is. You have Aubrey Plaza being the sarcastic, charming comedic relief
hacker,
that she can be.
Hacker girl.
Yeah, hacker girl, the comms expert. You have Hugh Grant, you got Josh Hartnett, we went through it. You have Cary Elwes playing the guy who's, sort of frustrated with his, top spy, because the big gag with Orson Fortune beyond the name is that he likes the finer things in life. So when he takes the private jet, he wants like the specific kind of wine. And that's the joke.
This
Otherwise,
movie
it's just Jason
has more
Statham.
Private jet scenes than any movie I've ever seen in my life. I think there's three or four different ones that they are on.
I think you're right. And there's always bottles of wine because that's the joke with the character.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I just say he's a ruthless killer, but he likes fine wine. And that's the joke. And I think that's the big problem.
Another big problem, you're right, is like, it's the same issue, is that like, we're being told Orson Fortune's this amazing, like, Ethan Hunt, James Bond type guy, but you never feel that or see that at all. The movie's just constantly like, yeah, Orson Fortune, he's the best. We got to get him. And like, that's fine. But like, did you catch the like, reactionary streak in the movie, which I would say manifests through Guy Ritchie like keeps poking fun at the idea that like the an FBI type agency or whatever you want to call this, like a CIA type agency, that they have like mental health programs that that people can exploit. Like they kept making that joke with Jason Statham, like, oh, he's taking his mental health break or whatever. Like, it just rang such like a weird conservative politics thing that I'm like, Guy Ritchie will just throw in some reactionary shit. And you gotta like it. Just, the movie moves right past it, so you'd never know it. You never notice it if you weren't looking for it. But I think I caught it three times when they make that same joke of like, isn't it crazy that like just making fun of the bureaucracy of like the idea that they would, you know, like the idea that the government's going woke and our soldiers are going through mental health processes and taking mental health days and stuff. Like it's. There's a weird humor.
I don't know about that, because I think the joke is he's just, I mean, it's not so much that he needs the mental health days, it's that he's just exploiting it.
And I'm like, is that Richie commenting on something, or is it just a joke?
I think it's
his weird sense of humor. Yeah.
I think it's just the extent of what Richie could come up with, which what would make us, you know, ruthless killer funny is if he likes, you know, staying at exclusive hotels and resorts and also enjoys drinking fine wine. And
this
I think that's
bullet train level humor where like,
yeah,
Brad Pitt's a killer, but he really doesn't want to be there or whatever the whole thing was there.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And I think that that's the big problem with the movie is that it wants us to feel connected to these characters and to laugh at them for being kind of goofy, but it never gives them a personality that goes far enough for that to register. It's really just all of these characters just being either sarcastic or, you know, Statham's character being a badass who occasionally, you know, will drink wine out of a fancy bottle. I don't know. There's something missing. There's this huge disconnect. And I think one of the big things, like you have, we didn't even mention Bugsy Malone, who's, I guess, a rapper out of the UK or maybe even in the US. I'm not sure. I've seen him.
British
in
rapper.
Before.
Yeah. Never but like, seen him. He was in The Gentleman apparently as well.
Yeah. He's introduced as like jack of all trades. He could do everything and everything. And he spends most of the movie like staring through the scope of a sniper rifle and kind of like explaining what's happening in the scene. Like, why do you have this character in here if you're not going to give him anything to do?
That's what I mean by uninspired, right? Like every scene feels that way. Like I'm like, ooh, cool, a chase is happening. This will be fun. And then like it isn't that fun. And then Jason Statham's finally fighting some guys, and it's all just like perfunctory. It's all like that's the only word that comes to mind. I'm like, yeah, it's ticking the boxes. Jason Statham's fighting a guy, and they're having a car chase in a foreign country, and like they're shooting on location. So like it has all the ingredients, but it's lacking some sort of. Honestly, it's lacking the Guy Ritchie visual flourishes that you'd expect. And on one hand, he has like this weird motif of like action without sound. And like that's the thing he goes for in this movie over and over again. It just none of it's particularly compelling. So it just kind of leaves you with this like half formed movie that you can't tell if it like what level of serious you're supposed to take it. And if you're supposed to take it seriously, like it's just the most who cares plot type of shit. And I think maybe it's just so close to that Nick Cage movie is why I felt it was so uninspired. It's just like kind of a happenstance. The timing doesn't suggest that they copied one another or anything, but I don't know. There's something like, I love the idea of the Josh Hartnett plot, but it doesn't even that doesn't manifest in that many interesting ways. It's just like, there's like a couple fun scenes in this movie, but like it's definitely some fun scenes in search of a more compelling narrative. But that being said, I would watch another one. Like I didn't hate it.
I mean, yeah, and he's clearly, I think a big part of the problem is that it does eventually have that plot with the MacGuffin. We find out exactly what it is and what it does and what it could do and how they have to stop
and
it.
And that's all actually that, quite timely. And like the delay in the movie coming out helped because it's like, oh, AI is everywhere now. And now it's a big bad. That makes sense.
Yeah. But it also does feel a bit rushed by that point. And it is, you know, Richie, it almost feels like Richie is like, you know, give me another chance with the sequel and maybe I'll give you some more details about these characters. Maybe we'll get some more team members who are funnier and have better things to do than the ones we had here. It all does feel like just so hasty in trying to get to the end of this movie and on to whatever he's going to do next with this series, which clearly he wants to be a series. And yeah, I mean, you know, maybe.
Yeah,
maybe
I wish we got a man from better. Uncle too, but this was pretty close, but not quite there. Did you like Man from Uncle?
No, but I don't remember how much I disliked it. If that makes any sense, I mean,
doesn't stick out or anything.
Yeah, it doesn't. I know a lot of people are fans of it though, but yeah, that one didn't quite click with me.
Yeah, well, this one didn't quite click with either of us, unfortunately. But I don't know. I'm torn between 2 and 2.5 on it because, like, I appreciate. Yeah, it's a 2. It's a 2-star movie. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
it's
you can't.
2 out of 4.
Yeah, I mean,
it's 2.5 out of 5, but it's 2 out of 4.
There you go. Yeah, it's 2 out of 4 for me.
All right. It's disappointing, but my co-host on The New Flesh, Jesse Hassinger, I sat next to him during it, and he had a fucking ball. He was laughing at everything. It really went over for Jesse. So if you're like, it was his favorite Richie since Uncle, and he likes most of them. So, you know, there are people who will like it. I think you got to be a big Richie head and pretty forgiving of what's going on and a big fan of all the people. It just takes a lot to take the good, you know. There's a lot of goodwill involved in liking this movie. I feel like you have to overcome a lot of things to be like, yeah, that was pretty good. Like, it's okay. All right. Next movie, Children of the Corn. This movie, man, I love the swings they take so much that I'm going to be more positive than I should be on this movie. That's definitely not good. But, you know, they tried to do a modern update, and I appreciate those swings. Here is Children of the Corn, 2023.
By Stephen King. Comes the nightmare. Like you've never seen it before.
I know. It sucks. It's so hard sometimes you can hardly breathe. But I can help. With your pain. Brace yourself. He who walks, he talked to me. He took care of me. So now I'm going to take care of him.
Like killing all the adults.
For starters.
Goofy trailer for a goofy movie.
That was weird. Nebraska, known for their mountains, apparently. A weird song choice.
Unbelievable. I'll let you take the lead here. Your review nailed it. I couldn't have said it better myself. You said all the things I wanted to say, because there's things worthy of praise in the ideas behind this movie, even if the movie is not worthy of praise. And I think you should go off with that.
Yeah, so here we are apparently with I've only seen the original Children of the Corn. I think that's it. But apparently this is like the 9th or 8th.
I think it's the
installment.
11th. Yeah.
It's some weird number that they made.
There's 11 if you count the like short film that preceded the original, I believe.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. Yeah, yes. So this is apparently a long-running franchise.
It's called Disciples of the Corn. You can find it on YouTube. It's also on the Shout Factory Blu-ray. Of the Children of the Corn 1984 movie, which you probably don't own because that movie kind of sucks.
And the whole franchise
kind of sucks. Yeah.
It's really not good. But beyond that, you know, it's Stephen King. And I think we've discussed, I love Stephen King as a writer.
Me
so
too.
There we are.
The short story is terrific.
Yeah. It's nice little thing about, you know, being afraid of being a parent and how kids can be inherently creepy and all that stuff. And here's a prequel, essentially a modern day reboot / prequel of that idea of, hey, how did all those weird kids in the cornfield who are killing adults turn into that? And it's a really interesting idea because, you know, the whole premise of the original story in the original movie is the kids are scary, they're creepy. And the premise of this one is maybe the kids have a point.
Yeah, maybe the parents had it coming big time.
And you know what? The movie opens with a mass killing at this daycare center, and the cops are incompetent and end up killing a bunch of kids and trying to do that. The entire premise is a pretty clear allegory for climate change and how the adults are just arguing about how they can make money off of it without caring about what they're doing to the crops of corn, what they're doing to the entire town and its economy, and what they're doing to the kids. It's a bit over the top, as a lot of this movie becomes. It's a yes. bit over the top, but the kids eventually ask for a vote to decide what's going to happen to the corn. And this is what dude...
children voting. Sorry. How the movie treats.
How it goes. And you're like, this guy is even as just like stereotypical villain in this cheap, cheesy horror movie, it doesn't work. But what I will say is I kind of think it's on the money in a certain way to say, like, yeah, you know what? Kids are in this world that is filled with violence, that doesn't care about their future, their present.
That opening scene, besides evoking other stuff, it's definitely evoking school shooting imagery.
Oh, yeah.
That stuff. And like Jesse and I talked about this on The New Flesh this week, but like the movie could have stood to just like do a school shooting instead of the very convoluted, dumb way it goes about the adults being responsible for what happens by killing those kids in the dumbest way I've ever seen anything happen in a movie that just totally strains credulity and isn't believable. But like, again, I don't really care about the specifics because the idea behind it is so potent, not only with the climate change stuff, but also like the school shooting, like cherry on top of like the parents, not like the idea of parents not giving a fuck about the future of their children and stuff like that. Like, all those ideas come together in so many ways. And like, so this movie starts and I'm like, oh my God, they're modernizing. They're doing like a classic horror thing of doing a modern reboot and like actually tackling modern themes and issues that are going on. And I'm like, I can't believe it. They're doing it. But then the movie tries to do like 15 other fucking things and none of them work. Yeah.
None of it works. And that's what's so bad about this, because I was all on board with this movie despite and because of all of the things that are going on. The weird townspeople who are just so like antagonistic towards kids for no apparent reason beyond. I mean, we get it. The parents don't care about the kids. They don't have to laugh in their faces while they're doing it. And then instead of following this one girl who's leading the revolution against the adults, we get like the centrist teenage girl who really thinks like, hey, you know what? Maybe the adults aren't so bad. And maybe, the future could be bright if we all work together. She's so dull. She has no point in this story except to just come between this, this character and the goals that she's going for, which is the whole point of the whole story, is that this is about kids rising up because that's the only way anyone's going to listen to them and their concerns anymore, because that's where it's gotten place.
You had that centrist who's like, the point of view is we should fix it the right way. And then you have the corn children who are like, no, we kill the parents. And the parents are just like, we take the government subsidies and fuck the corn. We don't care.
We don't care.
Yeah, it goes all in on allegory and social commentary. And again, those elements actually work. It's the other stuff that doesn't.
Yeah, there's so much. And you're right. There is so much other stuff, because eventually, I mean, we all know if you know the story, if you know the first movie, you know, there's a thing in the cornfield. It's a literal monster instead of everything else that's going on in the world and all that other stuff, all the allegory, all that, all the metaphor. No, it's a literal monster. And it is so cheap and so cheesy and so ridiculously designed.
It's crazy that they went for it with the budget that they had. Like, they clearly never had the money to pull off what they go for. So like, why even write it the way they did? Because it's basically like, I think it took me a minute to pull from my brain cavity what it looked like, but I think it's the monster from, what was that movie called a few years ago? A Monster Calls or something. It was like a tree monster. Yep. Yeah. Like, it just looks like that, but way worse, and kind of like the broccoli guy from Ant-Man Quantumania.
You're right.
Yeah, it looks like that. Or the green giant. It looks stupid, is my point. And with all the theme or the allegory metaphor stuff we're talking about, it's clear that we're both going to say, did it need the literal fucking corn monster? No, it didn't need it at all. So it's a bummer that it's there. But this movie also has like a, well, it's a horror movie, so we should have some nasty practical effect kills, right? There's a couple nasty kills that I'll give it. But like even those are marred by kind of cheap CGI on the edges or whatever. And the whole movie is cheap looking and clearly marred by reshoots. There's a scene where it's very clear that it was reshot because it's like a guy giving a speech at a meeting in front of a bunch of people and everyone's in the room together except for the guy speaking has clearly been reshot and the background's all different. And it's just like very cheaply made. And I'm not sure if it's just the kid, like there's something off about the energy of the kids. And I never liked that scene at the beginning where the kid's like walking a plank and I don't like, I think he's supposed to be walking to his death, but no one's acting as if that's what's going to happen. And it's very confusing to me what was going on. There's just, this movie is more, confuses you on very basic levels more than it needs to. Like, it's just kind of incompetent in telling its story. But again, it's not a terrible idea what they're doing. And it's just too bad that it's all the good stuff is covered up by all the bad stuff. Because it's fun to have a movie where, you know, everyone's always joking about properties going woke, but the Children of the Corn went woke and it worked until it didn't. So, yeah.
And when like it didn't, woke, it really didn't.
Yeah. The woke elements are great. The other elements are not so great. So, you know, give it some points for trying. I definitely give it some points for trying, but it's unfortunately still a bummer. But I have done, you know, this was a blind spot of a horror franchise for me and a Stephen King thing, so I've since seeing the remake, watched the original and read the book, which is very short and very good. You can find it online. I recommend reading it. It's really, really strong stuff. I'm curious. I think I'm gonna dive in and watch the 2 through 10. I've heard 2, 3, and 4 are actually interesting, so I have that to look forward to. But this movie, Children of the Corn 2023, a very generous 2 stars for me.
Oh, wow. A very generous 1.5 stars for me. And that's just because, yeah, I mean, it really is just the idea of it and the idea of taking it to that level and then just losing all that good faith that I had going for it with just dull conflict and terrible CGI monster. And really, really, I mean, we didn't even talk about like the entire climax that makes no sense involving a car that's leaking fuel days apparently, but also enough to drive.
Well, no, there's the one scene field where she's like running around, just like rubbing oil on stuff haphazardly. Yeah. It's
but weird. Still, I mean, the car,
no, it's stupid. It's very,
whatever.
Stupid.
I mean, none of it makes any sense.
No,
but you know, yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm giving it a lot of bonus points because the idea of it is so strong. But man, just
those bonus points only amounted to 1.5. I love it.
I know, but that's a lot when you think about it. But
I know it is. It is. It's not a good movie. I'll make that clear. Not a good movie, but I'm giving it credit for trying to actually not just do a it tried to make it its own. And I appreciate that, you know, it didn't just tell the story that the original did. It's not about a couple getting lost and, you know, finding the town of children. It's different. It's a different story. And I appreciate the swing, even if they did not connect. Let's jump to the next one, which is Palm Trees and Power Lines. This is a fucking tough sit, this movie. But I think it's powerful, even if it left me feeling terrible. And I'll never watch it again, probably. Here is Palm Trees and Power Lines.
I'm going to go out.
What?
You're going to just leave me all alone?
You're fine, Mom.
Stop. Stop.
Hey, are you okay? Come on, get in.
Oh boy, this movie is... is it hard to recommend? But I don't know if that's the right phrase I want to use. It's just like tough subject matter. It's not a fun movie to watch, but man, it packs such an emotional wallop by the end And like, I appreciated the like grace note that it ends on, just how fucking downer of an ending it is and what it implies, that I have to hand it to it. Ultimately, I'm just like, you did it. You made a movie that made me feel very bad. And believable. It was a movie that depicts something so believably that you believe the character would do the things that she's doing, even though it seems impossible that like she wouldn't see it that way, if that makes any sense. It's just like the movie is so true to its characters and it's what it's about, that it really rings true in a way that I wasn't prepared for. I'll expand on that in a way that makes more sense after Mark tells me more about what is this movie, Palm Trees and Power Lines.
It is, yeah, this really tough to watch movie about this. She says she's 17. We don't know that for sure. 17-year-old girl who gets into a relationship that starts as a friendship, then becomes more with this older guy. He's 34 for sure. We know that. Or at least that's what he says. And, you know, it's all so ordinary and so plain and so, yeah, believable that it's really terrifying.
It's so, yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah, because, oh no, it's, I mean, because we just see this teenage girl who feels like her mother is busy with work and busy with boyfriends and is kind of ignoring her and isn't listening to her and doesn't spend time with her. She's got a few friends that seem to be moving on beyond her. They don't really connect in a way that they were, because I think she has a best friend and the best friend has gotten on to this new group of other friends, and yeah, she feels left out. She doesn't feel a part of this group. She feels all alone and she's isolated. And then this 34-year-old man comes in and sees that, and that's, and you go from there. And I mean, yeah, it goes pretty much exactly where you think it's going to go.
And I would argue
a step further.
Yeah. Yep.
To a point where you don't think it's going to go.
Yeah. That's where, honestly, that turn, I wanted to turn on the movie. I was like, it didn't need to do this. I was like, it was telling this important story about a man grooming a younger girl and what that looks like and how susceptible they are to that specifically. And like, I was like kind of almost mad at it for taking that leap. But then when I realized that the movie's just operating on a different level that I wasn't prepared for, and I was like, oh no, it totally pulls off what it's doing. And I think it's because the movie has to work on these two levels of selling Tom as a bad dude, like from the perspective, well, it has to sell him as actually interesting to from the perspective of this teenager that we're following, but it also has to establish that behavior that anybody that isn't them would find suspicious, if that makes any sense. So like, you have to, it does that perfectly. Like you see her get groomed by this guy and you see why she falls for it, but you also see why everyone in her life is concerned, and like when the waitress intervenes. And like, there's so many moments when you expect this girl to, like, you know, shake her. You want to shake her and be like, fucking stop it. Like, stop doing this. Why are you doing this? But the movie constantly justifies, I feel like, that perspective. And it really, like, it hammers in everything you're saying with her friend group and her mom at home. And like, you really get why, you know, during the summer months before school starts, why this type of thing would happen, could happen to somebody, and how she would fall into it so hard. So it makes you totally buy the relationship, even when you, the viewer, are like, I don't, like, you shouldn't buy this relationship. You want to, you think you know better, and you want to think the character knows better, but I don't know, man. It's just like something about that. Like, is it the honesty of the ending that I'm reacting to, or the cynicalness of it? And I think it's both.
I think you're right. I think it's both. And yeah, I do have an issue with the scene that I think you kind of did too, because there is a scene that happens that's really
a long
tough
take
to watch.
Yeah.
It's not one single take, but it's a long scene. And This is, I believe, first-time feature. Jamie Dack is the director, the writer-director.
She did a short of the same title, I believe.
Yeah, and she did. But this is, that scene is tough to do, and I kind of understand how she's shooting it to make it seem as if it is taking her point of view, so that we're not focused on what's happening to her, but we're kind of focused on how she's responding to it. And I kind of appreciate a bit that idea, but I don't think it pays off and works quite as well as it could have of doing that, that trick of trying to tell us that something is happening to her, but it's not about the act. It's kind of hard to talk. I mean, I have to talk around it because it does, you know, come out of nowhere, but, I don't think it pulls it off, but the ending is where I think it does take it to a different level of realizing just how deeply this relationship between her and the older guy has just gotten inside of her. Despite and everything that happens,
she's young and impressionable, and her decisions are easy to justify when you're watching. Like, they're so dumb, but you feel her fucking aching for connection, right? And you just totally you totally see, like, you go, wow, that's how grooming works, huh? I never really understood, because, like, it's so easy from an outside perspective to be like, oh, that would never happen to my daughter, like, she's smarter than that or whatever. But, like, you watch this movie and you go, like, it doesn't matter how smart you are, there's, like, specific vulnerable emotional, like, just human things that these type of people take advantage of, and it's effective. And yeah, I mean, if you thought that long take, that long intense scene was hard to take, just the fucking casual brutalness of the actual last shot, even worse for me.
It's tough, definitely. Man. I didn't need that scene because of everything surrounding it to give you that sense of what's going on here. I mean, the suggestion of it probably would have been enough. I get and admire that the filmmaker's trying to do something slightly different and trying to, like, take it of her, like, separating herself from what's happening. I get it. I totally get it. I just don't think it's pulled off well enough in this. There's just a lot of subtle touches. There's this one cut that really got to me where she's with a bunch of friends. And then she's feeling like not part of it. And she just says, oh, I got to go because I got to help my mom out with something.
Yeah.
And just cuts to her sitting on the couch, watching TV, doing nothing. And it's just like, that's perfectly honest about something that would happen. And it gets you right into her state of mind. Just that action and that contradiction and that little tiny lie about everything. It's just, there's so many subtle touches that I don't know if that scene was necessary. And that's, like, my one hang up with the movie, I think, is that. It's a pretty big hang up, but I do appreciate what's going on here and what it details and how it presents it as something that is so simple that people can miss and that people who are involved in it aren't going to notice. Yeah, it's really strong stuff.
Strong stuff. It feels like an important movie that, you know, I don't know, the right people, it could be an important film to some people. I think it's getting at important issues in a way that is, you know, artful and interesting. It's a good movie. I give it 3 palm trees out of 4, and I wish I had a half so I could say 3 palm trees and half a power line or something.
I could give it 3 power lines, and there we go.
There you go. So, beautiful. Perfect. Beautifully done. All right, now let's take a trip to the doldrums and watch the trailer for some garbage that we'll talk about. And we'll leave the doldrums for one movie, and then we'll go right back into the doldrums. Here we go. The Donor Party. This is a real movie, I promise. Somehow these antics someone thought were funny enough and not completely off-putting enough to make the centerpiece of a movie. Here you go. This is real, I promise.
Oh, I ran into my ex with his beautiful new wife and their baby.
You remember her, Tia?
Last time I saw her, her face was covered by your crotch.
When we were married, he said he didn't want kids. And now I'm never going to be a mom.
You don't need a husband to have a baby. Just go and get some.
What? You know?
Mm.
Oh.
I don't want to sleep with some rando.
I want to know that the father of my child is a good person.
Right. What if we found them for you?
I'm thinking two, maybe three. We got a flood of fallopian tubes.
Okay. You're talking about an orgy?
No, that's insane. You can't do that. You can't just...
Although, it could work.
Is there nuts in that?
I can put nuts in it for you. Would you like that? I can put nuts anywhere you'd like.
Okay. I can do this. It's just casual sex.
Go on in, sleaze the day.
Hi.
Hi. Just like a game, I can make you play. I'm MJ.
Guys, can I help you with this?
No, thank you. I'm taking an Uber later. It's likely to be a sound mind when I'm in a car with a stranger.
Oh.
I kept it going when I noticed that joke was coming, because that is the one joke in the movie that made me laugh when I wrote it down. That Uber joke is funny. That is a funny joke. God damn. That is the premise of the movie right there. I couldn't believe it when that scene happened, which is like that trailer plays out like the movie does, just kind of quicker. It's like that scene happens where she runs into her boyfriend. Then she goes to talk to her friends and saying she's too old to have a baby, that she missed her chance. And they come up with the idea to have her fuck three guys in the same night, and hopefully one of them gets pregnant. And the idea is she's not going to tell them. That is what takes it from like off-putting to kind of reprehensible. But anyway, if that off-putting premise and antics don't work, maybe the terribly annoying characters will. It's just kind of the most off-putting thing I could imagine. And it would be all fine if the movie was funnier, I guess. But like, because none of the jokes besides the hilarious Uber one there really landed for me, it just kind of fell with a thud. And it seems like the whole thing is, can you believe how raunchy this is? Like, can you believe that this is the premise of the movie? Which I can't. So good job. But like, it doesn't really seem to milk it for anything that's actually interesting or funny. Right?
No, it doesn't. It's so weird. None of it really makes any sense, because I seriously was struggling the entire time. Like, where's the conflict in this movie? Where's the comedic potential in this premise? It's like you have Malian Ackerman trying to have sex with guys who want to have sex with her. And it's like, I don't get it. I don't get what's funny about it. I don't get where there's any kind of tension or suspense that could make it funny. None of it makes any sense. It's just like, you know,
it's funny because those guys are going to father a child and not know it.
No, but I mean,
I don't get it. Yeah.
This is weird of me. I don't see what the moral dilemma is with that. Even, I mean, like they kind of are like, I mean, I suppose because she's sabotaging the condom, that's maybe the worst.
You, it's like, not like she's casually poking holes in condoms,
which is dumb. But I mean,
yeah, I don't know. I don't.
The whole movie works around the entire need of a condom when you have that one scene with the Jeff Goldblum impersonator, which apparently that's also supposed to be funny. Is that the guy does a good Jeff Goldblum? Well, not even a good Jeff Goldblum, a passable Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah,
you understand big, that it's the concept of Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah.
And that apparently is supposed to be funny. And it's also supposed to be funny that Jerry O'Connell's character is a jerk and she doesn't want to have sex with him. And so what does that say about the friend who set her up to have sex with him that she doesn't even notice that? Oh, the friend, by the way, who did that is high on ecstasy the entire movie.
Oh, yeah.
Like, because I guess the filmmakers do. Yeah. There's
more
nothing
reprehensible
here.
Antics. They drugged somebody with Molly. Yeah.
I forgot they tried to. That was. I mean, yes, you could take that to the level of reprehensible because they tried to drug the first dude who's desperate to have any kind of contact with Malian Ackerman's character.
Yeah.
Try to drug him so he could have sex with her. Like, you don't need to do that. First off, it's wrong. And second off, you don't need to do that. When you put this guy in the same room with her, you don't need to do it. The movie makes it clear. It's trying to contrive all these crazy, wacky situations, one of them involving a turkey baster that is exactly what you think it is.
Yeah.
It's just so dumb. And I don't know why.
Yeah, gag is like, can you believe she's trying to turkey base the cum the guy just came on her back or whatever? It's just like, it's not interesting. It's like the whole joke is, can you believe this? Can you believe we're doing this? It's never actually funny or interesting. And I don't know, Malin Ackerman, I feel like her whole career is just like, does her agent hate her? What is going on? Like, she just does. I think she's really great. And I just don't think she's been in very many good things. She's just constantly kind of left adrift in movies. Yeah, it's a bummer.
I really didn't get this one. And I don't. There's so many possibilities of how this could have been funny, how this could have been interesting, how this could have approached whatever the moral dilemma is that they think it's going to be. Like, you know, instead of having the friend set her up with the dates, maybe she actually tries to find this guy to have, you know, a hookup with. You know, give us something instead of just throwing her into this party. And then
the whole movie's at the party and it just never fucking ends. It's just like, it feels like you're at a party that you don't want to be at. And so you shouldn't watch it. One sperm donor out of four for me.
One and a half. And I don't know why anymore.
You're giving it one palm tree and half power line. Okay.
Yeah. That
feels that's like, fair.
Yeah.
That's totally fair.
Now I'm talking about it, I don't know why, but here we are.
That's fine. Let's keep the these movies don't exist and aren't very good, but have stacked casts train rolling. Let's talk about A Little White Lie with a bunch of good actors. But it's not a good movie also. Here is A Little White Lie.
What if I told you that the man who is coming to this year's festival will put us back on the literary map? The man that vanished after the publication of his masterpiece.
I know who you are.
You do?
The mysterious Shriver.
Shriver?
Shriver?
Shriver, I thought he was dead.
Bring Shriver and bring a crowd. Because this is the last chance for this festival.
They think I'm someone else. I'm not a writer.
Everyone's a writer these days. When's the last time you were in a Starbucks?
My pleasure to attend your most esteemed and prestigious festival, which is totally my thing. Also is the prize a car. Okay, well.
I'm so bored rewatching that trailer. Just put me back in the headspace of watching this movie. Every week, Mark, I feel like there's an indie movie just like A Little White Lie that doesn't exist with a stacked cast. And you might wonder for a second when you see the poster, wait, why haven't I heard of this? And the answer is because it's the most boring fucking thing you've ever seen in your life. Every week, like clockwork. So what's this version? I'm being dramatic, but I didn't care for this very much.
I know you didn't. This version of that movie is Michael Shannon plays a apartment building superintendent who is mistaken for a famous reclusive J.D. Salinger-esque author by Kate Hudson's professor at this university. They're doing a literary festival. She writes a bunch of letters to a bunch of guys named C.J. Shriver, and he actually responds because his buddy says, hey, you should respond because you get a free vacation out of it. And he shows up, and there is, let's just say the movie has a tone problem because it is, on one hand, trying to be this sort of wacky satirical comedy about literary types at a festival where everybody's glad handing each other and everybody's boosting their egos and all this stuff. And then you have this case of intentional mistaken identity. And is he going to get found out? And how is he going to, you know, lie and pass off and get through all of this?
And through that, you get a story about imposter syndrome in writing and how it manifests. And like, I was interested in that, but you can go on.
Yeah. And then there is the other tone, which is what Michael Shannon is doing here, because he knows he's playing an actual character and not just the lead in this goofy mistaken identity comedy, because there is this whole second tone about Shriver, this Shriver, and his past and what he is and what he could be, what he might be, all this stuff that has like actual, it's trying for some sort of insight about who he is and who he was. And it doesn't mesh because that is the more interesting story. Michael Shannon's performance is kind of intriguing because he is playing against what you think this movie is. And you're drawn to it because you're like, why is he so subdued? And why is he not playing up like the whole thing? Like when somebody almost catches him in a lie, he's just sort of like there. There's no, he's not playing it for a bit. He's just playing it because like his character is going through some other stuff that has nothing to do with the premise. And so you have these two very completely different movies and storylines and through lines and all this stuff. And it never works.
It's so fucking flat, Mark. It's so flat.
Yeah. I mean, there could have been a interesting comedy. I do appreciate like this sort of atmosphere that it develops. I'm not saying it's funny. I'm just saying I appreciated this atmosphere of like what it would be like at
you
this
calling it a comedy
festival.
Made me think. I'm like, did I fucking laugh at all? Like,
but it is clearly trying to be a comedy when it's you know all about Don Johnson's character, and it's about that playwright who comes in, and it's about the wealthy patron of the arts played by Wendy Malick. It's clearly trying to be a comedy, and it's trying to be a wacky, goofy comedy, and it doesn't work as that because the real story here is not that story, and it's trying to hide that story from us until around the third act, and that story is much more interesting. And when it gets to it, it's just kind of all done. And I completely forgot. There's also like a missing author.
Oh, yeah.
He's suspected of murder at one point. And he does. Again, he's just sort of like shrugs it off.
Little farce, but it's just never. It's too uneven to be like compelling in like that fun, farcy way. I just like never bought into what they were selling me. So I was just like, it just was so fucking laborious. And a Michael Shannon performance does go a long way, but it's such an understated one that it's really like he's doing good work, but I just still just don't fucking care about this character. It was a tough sit for me.
I can gather that. I didn't hate it because I do think the basic concept of it is interesting. I think Shannon is good because again, he's playing a real character in the middle of all this chaos that should be a lot funnier, but it can't be funnier because the whole movie is about something else entirely. And man, if you had just made the movie about that story, might have had something. If you had actually just made a goofy comedy of errors and a farce about all the shenanigans at this literary festival, that could have worked too. Trying to blend them together and not deciding which one is more important to you, it doesn't work.
Well, there you have it. I don't have anything to add. I found this to be... I put the trailer up on our faces. If you're watching on the internet, sorry. I have nothing else to add on that one. I just found it to be very boring. I have nothing to say. It's a one and a half, though, because it's not abhorrent, and I appreciated that, you know, Michael Shannon... Like, it was trying to be about things, even if it ultimately... I didn't think didn't have much to say. It's trying. So 1.5.
2 for me.
Very nice.
And I'll leave it there. Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about one that I'm a little bit more enthusiastic on than you are. This is Hunt Her, Kill Her, a very no budget indie horror movie, but also like a cat and mouse thriller, the most base cat and mouse thriller possible. Hunt Her, Kill Her.
Have you worked in a place like this before?
No, sir.
You can see it's dirty. Floors need to be swept each night. You need a trash from each office, vacuum each office and hallway. Close all the doors, make sure they're locked. We had a break into the plant down the road the other night.
Does anybody else work night shift?
Nope. Just you.
She's stuck in here. Let's find her.
This movie boldly asks the question, what if Die Hard was a slasher movie and it was set in whichever warehouse the production could get on short notice? You know, Die Hard in a blank was like such a subgenre for a while, right? Like Die Hard on a boat under siege, Die Hard on a plane. I'm sure there is one. I don't remember. Air Force
Die Hard
One?
2. Die Hard 2 is Die Hard on a plane.
There you go. There's just Die Hard on was a subgenre for a while. And I feel like this movie is definitely evoking that. But it's also very much like a very bloody horror slasher. But it's basic. It's that you saw the setup. It's classic setup of woman gets job, night shift job. She it's her first day. And of course, on her first day, what happens? Four guys
like
show
four
up.
Four or five. Yeah. They keep adding as it goes.
A bunch of dudes show up who are there specifically to kill her. They're not there to like rob the place or anything. They're just there to kill her. And the movie is exactly what it looks like. It's all set in this one location in a furniture making factory that really makes you wonder, did they write the script about this and then find a place, or did they find this fucking place that was going to let them film there and then they wrote a script within it? I'm not sure, but it's like a very, you know, clear, like this movie didn't cost any money and it all works because of the like filmmaking and the fact that like it's actually really tense. You're basically just watching this woman get chased the whole time. And yes, the movie kind of cheats with how often they are very, very close to her and they could like turn to the left or right and they would see her and they don't. But like as a viewer, you're like, ah, don't see her. And it really works. I thought it worked the whole time. I definitely am noting its cheapness when I talk about it. Like it's definitely a very cheap movie with performances that aren't, you know, super strong, but I think, I don't know, I still like the lead. I just think, you know, the bad guys are all just voice changed archetypey guys. They're not really characters. But for a movie that's just like chase scene, it's a nonstop chase scene where it's actually a nonstop game of hide and seek, really. She's just hiding and then doing like Home Alone style traps for them and then killing them in various really disgusting and fun and inventive ways. And I appreciated that it's just like a woman in trouble picture. And she's not some superhero type. She's just a lady in trouble and she's resourceful and she makes mistakes and it's believable, except for all the moments where I'm like, yeah, this, they would see her. It like fudges a little bit, but I think it's mostly it's true to its premise. And I thought this was a lot of fun. I'm just not going to bury the lead. It's a 3 out of 4, solid recommend, really fun indie. Like this is what I want to see out of like a no budget indie. Like this, I thought it was really effective. Movies that have a fucking million times its budget are less effective. And I think it goes to show you don't need a lot to make an effective movie. You just, if you can, you know, editing matters, tension matters, suspense matters, all things that we shit on Cocaine Bear, for example, for having none of. This movie has tons of, and atmosphere and shit like that. I thought it worked quite well. What do you think?
I'm a little less enthusiastic about it, but I agree with all the nice points you made. Yeah, I do like that this is an ordinary woman. She doesn't have like a specific set of skills. She isn't trained to handle this sort of stuff.
In fact, she has like a handicap. Her hand doesn't work.
She does, yeah. She has an old injury that's set up like right away, and it comes into play in certain ways that are interesting and do add to the suspense in certain ways. This movie looks pretty damn good for probably being shot with nothing, like a favor with somebody who owns this warehouse. Who knows how they got in here, but it uses the space well.
Oh, that opening credit sequence is just like, we're going to take you through the entire warehouse with the camera. I love that. And then basically the whole movie, you do see every corner of that fucking place. So it's a great little tease.
It's a good little tease, good little space. I just ultimately, you know, when you have something this simple and this precise and this focused, it does need that very solid logic and it needs a consistency of the logistics of the thing. And I did have just enough moments where all of those, like, yeah, all this guy has to do is slightly look down. All he has to do is look straight ahead, which is what he probably would naturally do. And I can see like some people saying like, well, they're wearing masks and it's dark. And I'm like, yes, but that's not what the movie communicates to us. The movie communicates that they are looking in this one specific place. They're looking in this specific place. They're looking everywhere except for the one place that she's hanging with the guy's foot on her hand.
Yeah.
I feel as if he's going to notice.
You would some feel that. Part of that. That is the biggest cheat the movie does. And I gave it to it.
There's another cheat where she's hiding in a space and he almost looks in that space and then doesn't.
Yeah.
And then also looks again and somehow she has.
She's a ninja.
Completely silently. Yes. And that feels a bit. There's just enough of that for me to say, like, it doesn't hold up.
Sure. That's
the
fine.
Logic game, and it took me out of a fine piece of independent filmmaking as a thriller with some clever ideas. I like this. There's this one moment where she's making a sound, and she doesn't realize how she's making that sound where that sound is coming from. But all the guys notice it, and then she realizes, "Oh crap, I need to fix myself up real quick here because something's gone terribly wrong and they're going to be able to find me." Stuff like that is really clever and ingenious. But yeah, just enough of those moments that I can't fully recommend it because you got to have that script really tight. You got to have that staging really tight or you're going to notice those things. And I noticed them just enough that it took me out of it.
That's totally fair. I liked, at first, she kind of like accidentally kills them. Like, it's not quite Tucker and Dale horror comedy style where like the whole premise is these guys you think are the bad guys are really nice and people keep accidentally killing themselves in front of them. It's not quite that level, but like it did make me laugh. And like, this is going for horror comedy jokey kills in a way before it gets actually really gnarly. And I liked that it played on how hard it is to actually kill somebody. Like, that is another thing that I thought was kind of like a humorous flourish they did, which is like, Jesus, it would take a long time to choke somebody out this way or like shit like that. I thought that was all really funny. And just, I don't know. I was totally with this movie. Very tense, very visceral. If you're looking for the things that Mark is stating, you will find them. They're there.
They're there.
But I was willing to forgive them in this case of like a cheap movie that is just trying to deliver thrills. Like Jesse and I, when we talked about it, we kept saying everyone gives Cocaine Bear. They're like, just turn your brain off and enjoy it. Like, this is the type of movie that I'm like, just turn your brain off and enjoy it. Because I think it's like has merit to it. And they're actually trying to make you feel stuff. And they're putting in the effort to like make it a tense affair. And, you know, that's something that's lost in a lot of other movies.
I kind of now wish I could have turned my brain off a little bit more for this one because, when you put the comparison into it. Like,
Well, that's fine. You still rated it much higher than Cocaine Bear. So that's fine.
Oh, yeah.
Three stars, three Hunter Killers out of four. Not to be confused with Gerard Butler movie Hunter Killer. From a few years
ago. The submarine, not the submarine movie.
Good
that
movie.
Was a submarine movie, right?
Yeah, it was good.
But 2.5. I'm kind of regretting it, but whatever. I mean, like I said, I just could not move past some of that stuff.
That's totally, totally fine. And I can't move past this. I wish we could move past this next movie, actually, but we committed to it.
Yep, so promised it at the start.
Yeah, we did talk about it earlier, so here it is. Fucking. Oh,
you did a whole bit with an accent.
I did a whole fucking bit. You're right. I really have to do it. Yeah, Blue Bic. Here we go. Blue Bic. Here we go.
There's something I want you to see. You up for it?
Yeah. We're calling Blue Bic.
Gropers can live until their 70s. Old and wise. They live in the same place most of their life. They don't tend to leave. The only way to make sure that he's safe is to keep him a secret.
What's going on?
The entry to the bay is too shallow. We need to dredge the reef.
These fish are meant to be protected.
How can they do this, Mum?
Stealing from our future.
You and your mum really think you can stop this, don't you?
Those men, they wanted to kill him. What if he doesn't come back? What if I never see him again?
I feel like that trailer is more emotionally compelling than that movie. It just, I don't know. The movie didn't work for me on any fucking level. I was so bored the entire time. The structure of like flashing back to when she was a kid and now her mom's dying of a stroke in old age and she's trying to deal with that. But they keep cutting back to her fucking hanging out near this blue fish. Like, I never bought their friendship that I was supposed to get from this movie. It, very what you got from the trailer, probably. It's a very heavy-handed movie that is all emotional or environmental messaging, in search of a story, honestly. That's what it is. And maybe that makes for a better book, but I have very little to say about this movie, so I'll let Mark talk, and then maybe I'll return with an accent or something.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe you will. I don't know. I don't know how much I have to say about it, because you're right. It is in search of a story, because you have Mia Wasikowska starting off the movie, and she's the older version of this younger character in the flashbacks who learned how to become an environmentalist, a conservationist from her mother, who's played by Rhoda Mitchell, who's like the only one who seems to be giving a damn about what's going on in this movie. I bought her in the role of, you know, the activist. I bought that. But yeah, Mia Wasikowska apparently got a nice vacation to, I think it's her homeland of Australia, and got to stare out at a bunch of stuff. She got to stare out at the ocean from a boat. She got to stare out at a bay through the window of her childhood home. She got to stare out the bay from the beach of the bay. It's a lot of staring at things.
Big fish, the big grouper. I think yeah. When you say grouper in an Australian accent, it sounds like groper. So that's something you need to be wary of.
A little bit. Yeah. I was curious about all that. So the whole story is set in these flashbacks to Wasikowska's character learning to become an activist from her mother. And that's really it. And yeah, I don't know what else
I
to
just
say
don't
about
know
it, except
why I'm supposed to care. Like, it's like there's an element missing of like
there's a huge element missing. And I don't part of it is that it sets itself up as being about the friendship and the relationship with the fish. The fish doesn't show up. The fish shows up, what, like 4 or 5 times in the movie. You never get a sense of the bond. You never get any of that.
It really feels like a one-sided relationship. This fish is not involved. Yeah. This fish has no interest in Mia. It's really, who's going to break it to her? It's very sad.
I know. It is very, very sad that this fish clearly doesn't care, because it's a fish.
He's just not that into you, Mia. Move on, girl.
I really don't. There's a whole plot about this real estate land development / fishing company. I don't
Who
know what
cares?
They do. I know. And they're trying to take over the land and they're fishing too much. And Mitchell's character is trying to stop them with the power of her environmentalism. And I mean, yeah, if you want this movie to teach you a lesson, like, hey, the environment's kind of important. I mean, it does that. It doesn't tell a compelling story while trying to do that. It tells a very mixed up, structureless story about the birth of a young activist that I never bought.
If a structureless story about some activists you've never heard of sounds like your idea of a good time at the movies, check out Blue Bick in theaters now across the Outback. This is fun. I'm having fun doing the accent.
There you go. Eric Bana's having a good time.
Eric Bana, who was in this director's previous movie, The Dry.
The Dry, a much better movie.
A much
with an
better
actual
movie.
Story.
It's crazy this wasn't called The Wet. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for listening to Roger and Me. That was a fake me ending the show, but I think it's as good a place as
I think it's as good. Yeah. Got to walk out on a high note.
Blueback, I give 1 star out of 4.
Another generous 1.5 stars out of 4.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. See, I wasn't feeling a lot of the movies this week. It's one of those.
I wasn't either. Who just, yeah.
Existential crisis week of why am I doing this? Why am I watching the third 1-star movie that doesn't exist in a row? Why am I doing this? It's for you, listeners. It's all for you. That was in the Damien Omen voice. I hope everyone got that. Of course, you gotta shout out your references in case no one gets them. I'm really struggling to end the show here. This is the end of the show. We are back next week with too many fucking movies.
Yeah, so, a lot of movies.
And a lot of them are wide releases. We've got Scream 6. We've got 65 with Adam Driver. We've got Champions with Woody Harrelson, a Bobby Farrelly movie, I think.
Yep. And then some other stuff that we are still...
Some movies that don't exist, perhaps?
Some other non-existent movies that we are still in discussion on.
All right. So there's plenty to talk about next week. So we hope you'll come back and join us. I promise to do less Australian accents, unless there's a movie that calls for it. And then it'll be back like Blueback, baby. Blueback. Blueback. That's the only word I can say pretty good in Australian. Bye.
The show starts in one.
Shut up. Ush.